Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. Mark is the founder, president, and CEO of Community Health Center Incorporated, a provider of primary healthcare services for the uninsured and underserved in 13 cities and 218 service locations in Connecticut. Margaret is Senior Vice President and Clinical Director of CHC and is a family nurse practitioner by profession. Conversations on Healthcare is a weekly look at the people and ideas that are transforming the delivery of healthcare in America. And this week, Mark and Margaret will be speaking with Topher Spiro, Managing Director of Health Policy at the Center for American Progress. In the Tech Report segment, Marianne O'Hare reports on a new drug combination that's being used to greatly reduce the treatment time for tuberculosis. And we begin with this week's bright idea.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. 1 in 5 American vets returning from the front lines of Iraq and Afghanistan have come home with a so-called invisible wound. An estimated 20% of returned vets are suffering from the effects of post-traumatic stress disorder and severe depression. The Veterans Administration has been seeking numerous avenues to improve the outcomes for these soldiers, many of whom are afraid to seek help due to stigma. Often, they don't seek help until the condition has caused other major difficulties in their lives. Addiction, failed relationships, inability to focus on jobs or schooling, even attempted or completed suicide. A pilot program launched at the VA Medical Center in San Francisco is showing some promising results in getting veterans screened and into needed treatment. A brief therapeutic intervention called motivational interviewing done over the phone is significantly more effective than a simple phone check-in, the more common practice. The study, published in a recent issue of General Hospital Psychiatry, shows that when motivational interviewing techniques are applied, veterans are far more likely to see the need for treatment. Clinicians gently interview vets over the phone, encouraging the participant to discern discrepancy between their core values and their actual behaviors. If they articulate the need to change certain behaviors, they are more likely to acknowledge a need to engage in treatment. In the study, the control group received just the call-ins, where the other group received 4 weekly motivational interviews over the phone. At the end of the study, 62% of those participants were still in treatment versus 26% of the control group, and most reported reduced substance abuse and less of a sense of stigma about their condition. Using simple, targeted telephone therapy sessions to facilitate treatment and recovery for tens of thousands of vets who are suffering, now that's a bright idea.
We're speaking today with Topher Spiro, Managing Director of Health Policy at the Center for American Progress, an independent, nonpartisan educational institute dedicated to improving the lives of Americans through progressive ideas and actions. Mr. Spiro is focused specifically on promoting the implementation of the Affordable Care Act and promoting cost containment in healthcare. He served as Deputy Staff Director for Health Policy for the U.S. Senate Committee on Health, Education, and Labor under Senators Ted Kennedy and Tom Harkin, and was on the team that drafted the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. Topher, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
You know, everyone's talking about the most obvious aspects of the Affordable Care Act. I think the big three, the inclusion of millions of uninsured Americans into health coverage, people with pre-existing conditions who can't be denied coverage, young adults up to age 26 being able to stay on their parents' policy. But what are we missing in the discussion about the Affordable Care Act? What are the other aspects of the health care law that you think will improve Americans' health care system that aren't really being discussed by the people or the politicians?
I think what we're missing, what really hasn't given the Affordable Care Act enough credit, is the cost containment reforms that it includes. It really was the most far-reaching effort so far to contain healthcare costs. It included an array of reforms to the way healthcare is paid for and delivered, and these reforms reward the value and the quality of care, not just the quantity of care. And I think it's worth taking a moment to go through some of them briefly. For example, starting in October, this October, payments to hospitals with high rates of preventable readmissions and hospital-acquired infections will be reduced. Also, instead of paying a fee for each service, hospitals and doctors will receive a fixed amount for a bundle of services. This is called bundled payments, and this reduces incentives to increase the quantity of care. In addition, there's so-called value-based purchasing. That's when you link payments for hospitals and physicians to performance on quality measures. The Act creates a patient-centered outcomes research institute, which identifies what works best to improve the quality of care and healthcare outcomes. And finally, the last one I want to highlight is the Act creates an innovation center, which will develop and expand innovative payment models to improve the quality of care and reduce costs. So all these are examples of reforms to the payment and delivery system that will provide better care at lower costs. They're all essential to reducing healthcare costs over the long term, and the Affordable Care Act made a substantial down payment.
Well, Topher, that is a great overview of key main features of the Affordable Care Act that we're so glad you've talked about. And I wonder, again, trying to sort of educate and inform our public about the Affordable Care Act, maybe you could talk a little bit about the role of this entity called the Independent Payment Advisory Board that was also created under the Affordable Care Act. How is that playing a role in containing costs? Who do they replace? Who's on it? And why does it actually help make sense of pricing differences and costs in the healthcare market?
That's a great question. This is one of the key reforms to lower healthcare costs over the long term. And it's really to break the stalemate that exists in our political process where special interests lobby hard to prevent any reforms to increase efficiency of the healthcare system and to reform the payment and delivery system. So the board would reduce healthcare costs by implementing many of the reforms, the types of reforms that we just discussed. They're reforms that improve efficiency and cut waste. They are not reforms that will reduce benefits or ration care. In fact, the Affordable Care Act includes specific language to prohibit the board from rationing care, raising taxes or premiums, or increasing cost sharing or reducing benefits. So it's a key reform. It's one that is under attack, but hopefully it will stay in place.
Well, let's talk a little more about the cost containment value of the Independent Payment Advisory Board. But prior to this board, there was the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission, which initiated a plan to seek lower bids in medical purchase. And I believe this resulted in costs decreasing almost by 20%, saving Medicare millions of dollars. Tell us about what we learned from the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission about cost containment and how these are lessons being applied to the Independent Payment Advisory Board.
Well, this is a good example, a competitive bidding program. And let me step back and explain a little bit what that is. Instead of the government setting prices for products like wheelchairs, what Medicare would do is ask manufacturers and suppliers to compete to offer the lowest price to Medicare. So these are market-based prices, and oftentimes they're lower than what would have been set by the government. And this reform was experimented with in the early 2000s. It was found to reduce prices by 20% and save Medicare about $8.5 million without affecting quality or access. And based on the results of that experiment, the Independent Medicare Payment Advisory Commission, which advises Congress on Medicare, recommended expanding competitive bidding in 2003. It was a no-brainer. Congress did ultimately phase in an expansion of this program, but only 2 weeks after the program was first implemented in 2008, Congress terminated the contracts that existed and delayed the program. It wasn't until 2011, last year, that the first round finally went into effect, and the benefits to seniors and taxpayers were substantial. The average price savings was 35%, and is projected to save taxpayers $17 billion and beneficiaries $11 billion over 10 years. So this is an example of a reform that got delayed by special interests in Congress. It was a no-brainer. Ultimately, it will be expanded under the Affordable Care Act, but it took many years for that to happen. The Independent Payment Advisory Board, which we've been discussing, would have the authority to put this type of reform into place unless Congress can come up with a better reform that saves the same amount of money.
Topher, I think that you've just made very clear to a lot of people some of the cost saving and cost containment measures. And I think one of the things that's kind of driven the public crazy is one group says this will save America billions and another group says this is going to cost America billions of dollars, right? But an area of cost containment that there hasn't been so much talk about is how do you contain costs through providing expanded coverage? And of course, we're going to take a good chunk of our 50 million uninsured Americans and provide them coverage by 2014 through the exchange and through expanded Medicaid and other mechanisms. Maybe you could talk a little bit about how expanded coverage and expanded access to care serves as a cost containment measure in some ways as well.
Well, of course, there's the point that we're trying to transform our healthcare system from a sick care system to a healthcare system where we provide access to preventive care that can save costs down the line, because emergency room care and institutional care at nursing homes, for example, is more expensive oftentimes. But the other point I want to make is that by having more people in the system, you broaden the health insurance pool, which means that you're bringing in healthy young people as well as sick and old people. You don't just have a system that's for one segment of the population. And by doing that, you lower premiums for everyone. This is where the controversial individual mandate comes into play. The whole purpose of that is to address the problem where people who don't have insurance show up at the emergency room and then expect their care to be paid for, and that care is not free. It's paid for by taxpayers. It's paid for by higher premiums for everyone else. So if instead we can encourage those people to get insurance up front and not just show up at the emergency room, that should lower premiums for everyone.
We're speaking today with Topher Spiro, Managing Director of Health Policy at the Center for American Progress, an independent, nonpartisan educational institute dedicated to improving the lives of Americans through progressive ideas and action. Mr. Spiro is focused specifically on promoting cost containment in healthcare through the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. Topher, one area where there still seems to be quite a bit of uncertainty is health insurance exchanges. And these exchanges need to offer policies providing essential health benefits. I'm not sure if those are sort of minimum level benefits or not, but you know, I think this is really generally good news for consumers trying to buy insurance on the open market. Tell us about these essential health benefits and why they are so important to the work of the insurance exchanges.
Well, the Affordable Care Act has a requirement that new health insurance plans in the markets that offer insurance to small businesses and to individuals directly, so not through your employer, that they cover essential health benefits, which is an extremely important consumer protection, and it's one that makes the exchanges and other health insurance market reforms work much more effectively. There are several purposes of essential health benefits. The first main one is to ensure that coverage provides access, of course, to essential health care. The law requires coverage of benefits within 10 broad categories, including maternity and newborn care, mental health benefits, prescription drugs. Many of these benefits are not typically covered by plans offered directly to individuals today. So these benefits will go a long way to ensure comprehensive coverage. The second purpose, I think, of this requirement is to say that insurers cannot design benefits to attract healthier individuals and deter sicker individuals. They can't, in other words, design plans that cherry pick only the people that they want to cover. And then the third major purpose of this requirement is to provide some standards to make it easier for consumers and small businesses to make apples to apples comparisons.
So, Topher, the health insurance exchanges were intended to be set up on a state-by-state basis, but of course we've heard a lot in the news about those states that, at least in this pre-election phase, have said that they're going to opt out. But they won't go without an exchange. They will, by default, have an exchange set up by the federal government. What are your thoughts on the implications for residents of those states that are not setting up their own exchanges in terms of benefits and policies available to them? Will it be one exchange for the rest of the country where the states haven't put one in place, or how's that going to play out?
Well, that's exactly right. So residents of Texas, for example, if Texas decides not to have an exchange, they don't need to fear that they won't be able to access the benefits of an exchange or the coverage that's made available through an exchange, because the federal government will work with the state of Texas, for example, to set up what's called a federally facilitated exchange. And what's important is that many of the insurance market reforms in the Affordable Care Act are minimum standards that apply across the country, regardless of whether a state decides to set up an exchange on its own. A good example is the requirement to cover essential health benefits that we discussed. Another example, of course, is the ban on discrimination based on health status. So insurance companies can no longer deny coverage for pre-existing conditions, for example. That protection will exist across the country in 2014, regardless of whether Texas or other states decide to set up their own exchange.
We haven't really touched on the quality of care, which is one of the triple aims of the Affordable Care Act. And we recently had former Vermont Governor Howard Dean on the show saying he felt that the accountable care organizations supported by the health care law really had the power to improve quality of care by offering comprehensive patient-centered care. What aspects of the accountable care organization do you believe show the most promise in delivering cost containment and improving quality of care?
Well, let's step back and talk about what an accountable care organization is. It can mean many things, but basically it means a team of healthcare providers, including a hospital, physicians, nurses, that is accountable for all of a patient's care. And this encourages the team to coordinate care. And if they do a good job, they'll be able to keep a part of the savings that result from reducing costs from coordinating care. A good example in the private sector, actually, was established by Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts in 2009. They set up an accountable care organization that includes 1,600 primary care physicians and 3,200 specialists. It's been going on for 2 years now, and there are promising results already. It has been shown over 2 years to reduce healthcare costs by an average of almost 3%, which may not sound like a lot, but if you take 3% across, you know, across national spending on healthcare, that's billions of dollars every year.
Topher, you have a number of such impressive advisors on your board, former CMS Administrator Dr. Don Berwick, Harvard economist David Cutler among them, and they all say pretty similar things. The health reform law, the Affordable Care Act, isn't perfect, but it's a solid foundation for moving forward. And as we have recently survived the Supreme Court hearing and anticipate it going forward and full implementation, what's part two, do you think, as you put on your futurist hat and you think how these are the things that would need to be in the next set of legislative changes we make to continue to make progress in advance? What would you see those things being?
Well, I think it comes back to cost containment. I think the Affordable Care Act, really, you can think of that as the first generation of reforms to reduce healthcare costs. And there needs to be a next generation of these reforms. This is actually something that we've been thinking a lot about, David Cutler and Don Berwick, Zeke Emanuel, Peter Orszag, among others. And we're going to actually propose some bold reforms in the near future. I think this is the next step, is to really focus in on cost containment.
Tell us about any of the states that you've been working with that excite you in terms of, and we always sort of think of about states as sort of the engine of innovation, and tell us what you're seeing out there in terms of states that excite you in terms of the of addressing cost containment, but also improving quality.
What really I think is important is innovations that focus on primary care, which you don't hear about as much. Focusing on primary care can achieve better outcomes at lower cost. The U.S. has a very high ratio of specialists to primary care physicians, and it ranks at the bottom in measures of primary care. So we need to look at health systems that have a higher, you know, percentage of primary care physicians, which results in more effective care, lower use of healthcare services, lower Medicare spending, and higher quality. So I look for innovations called primary care medical homes, in which again, teams of primary care physicians, nurses, all work together to reduce costs and improve the quality of care. And the innovations that are most exciting to me are the ones that allow patients to engage with physicians more meaningfully. In this day and age, I can't understand why patients can't communicate with their doctors through email, for example. This kind of engagement and interaction is long overdue. We need to bring the practice of medicine into the 21st century. And there are examples across the country of both in the private sector and the public sector innovations that are implementing these types of reforms.
We've been speaking today with Topher Spiro, Managing Director for Health Policy at the Center for American Progress, an independent, nonpartisan educational institute dedicated to improving the lives of Americans through progressive ideas and action. Mr. Spiro's organization is focused on improving healthcare in the United States under the Affordable Care Act. Mr. Spiro, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Emiliano here with this tech report. TB, tuberculosis, is one of the oldest recorded diseases on the planet and yet remains one of the more neglected diseases in terms of treatment options. There hasn't been a new drug treatment for TB in over 40 years, even though a third of the global population actually carries the TB bacterium in their system. That is, until now. The TB Alliance, which is a consortium of researchers and scientists from around the world, recently announced a new drug combination that seems poised to greatly reduce treatment time from what could be years of doses down to a couple of months with a three-drug regimen versus the current four-drug regime.
What we found with this particular three-drug combination is that over 99% of all bacteria that they coughed up were eliminated in the course of just the 2 weeks. And that was better than a group of patients in the study that took the standard four-drug regimen. So that was very encouraging.
Dr. Daniel Everett of the TB Alliance says the AIDS epidemic has taken TB from being a long-neglected disease to one that's being given much closer scrutiny. In spite of the large number of people who carry TB, it doesn't often manifest unless someone contracts an immune response inhibitor, like AIDS. In the clinical trials, they've treated 85 TB patients in South Africa with this new three-drug combo they're calling PAMZI. Since their findings were so remarkable, the trial has been expanded to a much larger group. Phase 3 will be a one-year follow-up to see if the bacteria are completely eradicated.
Approximately a year of follow-up is given to be sure that people don't get better and then have a recurrence, you know, of some of these quiet sleeping bacteria over time.
What's exciting about this new regimen? Well, it's much more efficient and requires much less of an investment, which Dr. Everett says really will be a game changer in battling TB.
That could reduce the cost of treating somebody with multidrug resistant TB by about 90%. It could be one-tenth of the cost and a much shorter regimen, many fewer drugs, no injections. And that would really be a game changer and a huge step forward.
And best of all, these drugs can be successfully used in patients with drug-resistant TB, a growing problem. Dr. Everett says there will ultimately be a TB vaccine, but for now, there's hope that for the millions of people living with tuberculosis, a faster, more affordable cure could be around the bend. I'm Marianne O'Hare with this Tech Report.
If you have questions for Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter or would like to subscribe to the podcast, you can visit them on the web at chc1.com. The Health Forum is part of Connecting Our Communities from Connecticut Public Broadcasting in partnership with area nonprofits, and production support for Conversations on Healthcare has been provided in part by Community Health Center Incorporated. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public radio station.